You're listening to episode 171 of the Writing Life podcast from the National Centre for Writing, weekly podcast for anyone who writes. I'm Simon Jones.
And I'm Steph McKenna.
And remember, it's the 5th of November, 2021, here in Norwich, as we're recording. How are you doing today, Steph?
I'm good, thank you. Yeah, not too bad. I've got no fireworks to look forward to, actually. Maybe I need to make some quick fire plans this afternoon.
So the big news today is that the category winners from the East Anglian Book Awards have been announced at long last.
Yes. So the East Anglian Book Awards are an annual event that we run in partnership with Gerald, the Eastern Daily Press, and UEA Faculty of Arts and Humanities. And these awards celebrate the very best in writing and publishing from the East of England. So the six titles, the category winners, as you mentioned, for 2021 have been revealed. You can find them on the EDP website and on our website. And those category winners will now be considered by our panel of judges for the coveted £1,000 Book of the Year Award, sponsored by the PACAR Foundation. Once the judges have made their decision, we will be hosting a very special online event on Thursday, the 25th of November at 6:30 p.m. You can tune in online on our YouTube channel to find out who has been awarded the Book of the Year Award, as well as the Book by the Cover Award, which is judged by members of the East Anglian Writers, and the prestigious Exceptional Contribution Award for an individual's work within writing and publishing in the region. So that event, as I say, will take place on YouTube, and it's completely free to register your place now. If you do so from our website, it means we can send you the streaming link on the day and you can join us for the announcement.
Yeah, and it's going to be a really fun evening. We've got all of the writers that have won in the categories showing up to talk about their work and be a nice little celebration of some of the amazing creative output that's come from the region. So, Steph, what do we have on the podcast today?
Well, so today's podcast is with Adam Zed Robinson, who is a writer, performer and theatre maker. I met Adam online during lockdown, actually. He was hosting these fantastic regular workshops over Zoom to give people, you know, something to tune into each week, do some writing exercises. And it was a really positive and nurturing environment. I really enjoyed it. And since then, I've sort of delved deeper into Adam's work, and he's extremely prolific. His most recent play Upon the Stair premiered in January 2020 and went on to a week-long run at Harrogate Theatre. His plays, The Book of Darkness and Light and Shivers, which are ghostly themed, as you can imagine, have toured extensively around the UK. He's currently working on, he's got an adaptation of A Christmas Carol, which is about to go on tour. And his other writing includes Conscientious, Seaside Terror and a short film, The Split. He leads workshops independently and with organisations such as First Story and Arvon. So I met on Zoom with Adam a little while ago, and we had a chat about his playwriting, his short story writing. He's very interested in ghost stories and the gothic especially, which felt like a nice topic around Halloween. So we had a chat about that, about what makes a good ghost story. And he also shed some light on his book podcast, his workshops that he hosts, and how he uses Patreon to sort of bring together his supporters, create a bit of a community, and also earn a bit of money as an independent writer, which is very, very important too.
Yeah, he's so full of ideas and projects. And something that's really interesting in your conversation is how rapidly and creatively Adam adapted to COVID and lockdowns, because obviously working in theatre, which had to just stop entirely, particularly in 2020. But Adam, you know, he's got Patreon, he's got his workshops, he pivoted to delivering plays online in various forms. There's so many good ideas and ways of adapting to the weird circumstances that we've been in.
Yeah, like you say, he's extremely dynamic, and I really enjoy his work. So I hope you enjoy the interview. I had a great time chatting with Adam. I could have spoken to him for hours longer, I think. Once you've listened to the interview, please do check out Adam's Twitter and his Patreon, because he's got lots and lots of content for writers. Every month he's releasing workshops, live performances, tips, podcasts, all kinds of things. He's just he's a wealth of knowledge and a really nice chap.
Yes, and we'd originally intended to put this podcast out right at Halloween. We were a few days after that, but I think horror is for life, isn't it? Not just for Halloween.
Well, yeah, if you ask me particularly, it's a year-round ambition. So I don't mind it coming out a few days later.
Okay, well, let's head straight over to your chat with Adam.
Adam, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me. Welcome to the Writing Life podcast. How are things?
All right. Thanks for having me, Steph. This is really exciting. I'm really pleased to be here. Yeah, things are okay at the moment. A particularly tricky time. It's things are all right. I'm feeling quite hopeful.
Good, good. Where are you speaking to us from?
I'm in London.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah. I spend a lot of my time in the north, but obviously since COVID, a lot of my theatre projects that are mostly in the north, I haven't been able to go up quite as much in the last couple of years, as you can imagine, but already planning to be back up there working on some projects in the next few months. So can't wait to get back up there.
Yeah, I bet you're so relieved that things for theatre in particular are starting to get moving again. You're starting to make plans. We'll talk about that in a bit more detail. But yes, you must be feeling quite relieved.
I am. Yeah, I'm feeling hopeful about it. It's still, there are still lots of trepidation around it. And I understand people. I think people are really excited to get back into the theatres. That's the sentiment I'm hearing. But also, the pandemic isn't over by a long stretch, and I think caution and safety have to be at the top, don't they? They really do. So it's that strange, it's that strange double feeling, really. I feel really excited about it, and also there's a bit of nervousness and a sense of I don't know, a duty of care. Is that a bit strong? Yeah. But a sense of, bringing people back into the auditoriums during what's been a really difficult, challenging, dangerous time for lots of people. So I feel excited. And also there's that slight cloud hanging as well.
Have you been to the theatre yet yourself, in the audience, to anything?
I have, yeah.
Have you?
I got along to see 222 by Danny Robbins.
Yes. Is that the Lily Allen?
Yeah, Lily Allen stars in it. Yeah. And it's a ghost story. So that's kind of on brand for me. I got along to that, which was really interesting. It was a very strange experience because it was West End and it was really busy. It was the press night. So it's really, really busy. And it was kind of, elbow to elbow. And the theatre did have a pretty good sort of COVID policy. And so that was really reassuring, to read that before I went. That was good. But it felt odd. It felt strange. And I had a stranger next to me. And we were sort of just nattering about it and about how great it was to be back. But also, we were wearing masks for the majority when we weren't, drinking our drinks. We were wearing masks for the majority. And it was pretty soon I was able to relax into it, to be honest. And I sort of forgot about everything else except the production. But no, it was nice. It was nice to be back. I felt pretty emotional, I must say.
Oh, fantastic. I haven't been to the theatre yet. The most I've done is the cinema, but I'm hoping to get back soon. So,
do you remember that really odd period during, it might have been the first or second, after the second lockdown, where they opened some theatres tentatively and it was all massively socially distanced and all that?
Yes.
I actually managed to get along to Alan Bennett's Talking Heads at the Bridge. Yeah. And I must say that was extraordinarily moving. Like I felt really, really, I mean, I love Alan Bennett. I love those monologues, but I felt really moved just to be there. And it was weird because it was really massively socially distanced and the theatre were being so good about it. It was all one-way systems and lots of hand sanitization and all. They were really good at marshalling it. But looking back on that time now, I just think that was crazy, wasn't it? Like what was going on then when they sort of were like, yeah, let's try and open things. And I don't know. Yeah.
It already feels like so long ago, actually, that period.
It does.
I feel like I haven't come to terms with it properly yet either. Like, is this going to come and haunt me in a few years and go, what was that insane period?
Absolutely. And I think that's such an interesting point about coming to terms with it, because I don't think I have either. Because the first thing I did was, I thought to myself, I need to be busy. I need to do something. And just sort of threw myself into a different sort of work, but work. And I don't think really I paused or have paused at all really during the whole pandemic to just take stock and just go, all right, so how do I feel about that? How has that affected me? And I've been really lucky. I haven't been personally affected by the virus. We had to isolate one time, and
same.
That was about which way?
That was annoying enough.
Yeah, a lot of delivery meals and
You certainly didn't lean into having some downtime, did you? I think you're a fantastically busy person, and that actually leads me on to asking, for anyone who is listening who is new to your work and to you, could you tell us a bit about yourself?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I realize, we've talked for about 10 minutes and nobody knows who the hell I am. So I better, hello, I'm Adam. I'm a writer. I started off, I guess, when I was at university, I started doing theatre stuff. Before that, I was very much doing poetry, which I now don't do at all.
Yeah,
bizarre.
I didn't know you were a poet. That's
not... Yeah, well, I don't think I am really. I
hidden
mean,
depths.
Well, hidden shallows, perhaps. I don't know, but in my case, but when I was young, I was really into like Simon Armitage because I realized, I don't know, there's something about his poetry that made me think, you know what? Poetry can sound like anything. Writing can sound like anything. He was somebody who sounded a bit like me because I'd seen him sort of reading his stuff live. And suddenly a light went on, I guess, because at primary school even, I was really into the idea of story writing. And I remember I found my old leavers book recently, my dad's house. I say recently, it's like 2 years ago, but that's recent these days, isn't it? There was a little message from my teacher at the time that said, good luck for the future. Invite me to the launch of your first novel. And I had forgotten that I had any interest in writing at primary school. And suddenly there was this little cute message. Secondary school, as I say, Simon Armitage was a big thing for me. Then Ted Hughes. And I just started having a go, throwing some words down on the page, sharing it with a couple of people who I sort of trusted at school. All through college, writing workshops. And then at uni, I set up a poetry night with a good friend of mine called Andy Craven Griffiths, who's an amazing poet, and he's working in theatre now as well, which is great. And me and Andy set up this night called Sticks and Stones. And it was this spoken word night. We got some of the best spoken word artists in the country and then sometimes globally as well. Like Inuit Elms was one of our regular guests back in the day. Polar Bear, you know, Stevie Camden. And we had Brendan McLeod over from Canada as well. Also, all sorts of people, and it was just an absolutely fantastic experience to do that. But I think I realized, like, poetry, I wasn't as good as the people who I was sort of, you know, coming in week in, week out. So, I moved over to theatre. Theatre group was a big thing when I was doing my master's at Leeds. And I went to see a couple of plays. I was like, you know what? I find this really intoxicating and I want to have a go at it. So I wrote a play, proposed it to TG, and they were like, let's do it. Let's do that. So that was the start
first
of the theatre,
play.
Really. Yeah, I mean, it was rubbish.
But still, it went somewhere. It didn't just sit in a drawer.
But that's all right. This is the thing. I'm a big advocate of just do it, you know, and look back on it in a few years and realize how far you've come. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
But that's where it started. Yeah.
And you've done so much since. I mean, I've known you and known of you and followed you on social media and things for quite a while. And your online writing workshops played a key part in getting me through a lot of the lockdown period, actually. Thanks. As a self-confessed, very shy writer, it was a really nice opportunity for me to go, you know what? I'm too shy to go to a course in person at the moment. Why don't I give online a try? Because I'll be sitting in the comfort of my own house. But I can, you know, I can give this a go. And it really was fantastic. So
good.
I know you as you say, a playwright. You're a workshop facilitator. You're a film fan, which is another crossover between us.
You're a
performer. You write short stories. You're a podcast. You've got a podcast. You're a podcast type. You're basically an immensely skilled and busy person. We were discussing this beforehand, before I hit record. And just a very, very busy person. Is it fair to say that theatre is your main line of interest?
I think it is, yeah. And it happened a bit by accident. As I say, I proposed that play at uni, had a play on the back of that one, go to Edinburgh. So I'd sort of written three full-length plays by the time I left, finished my master's. And suddenly, yeah, I got the bug. I loved the organic nature of theatre. I loved the sort of teamwork involved in theatre. I loved the idea that you can hand something on to a group of other people and they can transform it into something immense, you know. But yeah, I think it is my main area of interest. The performing thing came out of nowhere because I had no aspirations at all to act at all. I really didn't. Yeah. And I got a little bit of money to do this event at Light Night Leeds, which is a brilliant arts festival in the city that happens, used to be one night and I think it's over a couple of nights. And it was all sorts of things all over the city. And I was really interested in ghost stories. And I proposed this idea of doing a live ghost story reading in this old kind of church, Leeds' oldest church it is, in fact, St. John's in the centre, and with a live violin score. And I was like, that'd be a cool thing to do. I've been playing with this idea. So I got the money, looked at it, kind of looked at what we'd been given. And I was like, there's no money. If I want to take anything from this, there's no money here to pay an actor. So I sort of decided I would do it. And it was like, it was just going to be this reading. And in fact, it was a reading because I had the words written down in what became the Book of Darkness and Light, which is the name of my theatre company as well. And we just did it. And I was so nervous and I was so unsure of it. But all we got after that night was just lovely compliments. Everyone had written really nice stuff in this feedback book at the back of the church. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. And by that point, my first touring play had been up and down the country, a show called Conscientious. We'd done a tour of that, which was I'd written and had nothing to do with the direction or performance or anything. But it was kind of soon after that. And I was like, you know what? We're going to do another couple of these and let's just see if I enjoy it, if people enjoy it. And if that's the case, then we will. And we
did. It was
a
happy accident.
It was a total happy accident. And then, you know, cut to a few years later and we were touring Shivers to like 33 theatres up and down the country. Wow. And suddenly, yeah, I'd gone from, you know, just doing the writing side of things to actually getting on stage and performing it.
I wondered actually whether you had started with performing, you know, in the way that actors on film sometimes try their hand at directing or something later. I thought maybe he began as a performer and then found a love of writing, but it was the other way around.
The other way around. And a total accident. And I still sort of, when people talk about the, you know, they might write a little comment and it'll say something about the actor in the play. It takes me a minute to go, oh, they mean me. It's me.
That's
I
you.
Get it. And it's the only thing I do. I would do other things. Like I'm very open to conversations. but it is the only thing that I've done. But yeah, I love it. I think it's one of the things that I love most, actually. I find it so calming on stage, weirdly.
So terrified. So that
this is the thing, and it's just me for it was for the first two shows, just me and a violin player. So if anybody forgets a line, it's me. You know, Ben, who I played, who was the violin player for the first two shows, would always, you know, cover me in that eventuality. But what I'm saying is, I didn't have another performer to sort of prompt me or anything. But I found it and still find it extremely calming. And I wonder whether it's, I don't know, there's something about the extreme focus of it. Mm-hmm. Like, meditation really helps me in general. And it's kind of a form of meditation because you're just there under the lights. Everyone's got to be quiet. That's the rule. And you're just focused, I guess. You're just focused on one thing. I go through a whole tour and I'm just so zen. And then I miss it and there's this massive sort of come down after it.
I bet. Well, I mean, clearly that shows that must be your natural place for you to feel that calm. I mean, it sounds like my waking nightmare. So it must be your natural state of being for you to feel that zen on stage.
It's not that bad once you get on there. Fake it till you make it. That's what I tell myself all the time. I'm just like, get on stage and just be like, even if I don't believe in my own abilities necessarily, I believe that other people might believe in them. So I can just riff on that. It's fine. But
I'm
going to
take your word for it. I'm not going to try it myself. I will take your word for it. Sounds brilliant. No. You mentioned ghost stories, actually, and I'm quite pleased that this discussion is going to air around Halloween, because I wanted to ask you about your relationship to gothic and ghost fiction, something that is a mutual point of interest. And I've also experienced your ghost story writing workshops firsthand. So you've written stories of this kind for stage as well as sort of short stories. What is it that attracts you to this genre in particular?
I loved them. Ever since I was a kid, really. I was really interested in quote-unquote true ghost stories when I was a kid. Anything to do with hauntings and stuff like that, just was totally fascinated by. Really got into horror from far too young an age, frankly. But and I pretend like it never did me any harm. I don't think it did.
It strengthened you. It made you, it strengthened you as a person. That's what I like to argue.
Yeah, exactly. That's true. I was always a bit obsessed with ghost stories. I got to, as I say, I was writing poetry and stuff when I got to university and I kind of left it alone for a bit. And even when I started writing, you know, professionally, as in, you know, my first touring play was happening, that wasn't supposed to be a ghost story. And it's actually not. Conscientious was about a woman who was experiencing workplace bullying. Mm. And it was also about her contemplations of her great grandfather, who was a conscientious objector. So it's about this idea of conflict and where we are today versus what, you know, people of that generation were facing, and whether we should, you know, the main character was sort of feeling a little bit unworthy of the feeling she was having about this conflict she was facing, because she was comparing it to something much bigger. Mm-hmm. And the director, Alex Chisholm, we did a little interview thing that was going online. And the thing she said about it, she said, it's a ghost story. And I was like, what? Is it? If you saw the play, I think you'd understand what she meant. There is an element of her, of this woman being haunted, but it's not mm-hmm. like a gothic ghost story. But there was something, a light went on at that moment, and I wrote a little blog post saying, you know what, next year in my writing, in my career, I'm going to embrace gothic, because I love gothic, but I've sort of been pushing it out a little bit in favor of doing something else. But I love it. It's really fun. I know it really well. So that's when I sort of got a bit serious about doing it from a professional point of view, and the Book of Darkness and Light came along. A few years before that, I'd had this blog with an artist called Max Story, which was called Tales from the Red Barn. And they'd gone up, and again, people really responded well to them. And I don't know, there's something you can something quite unifying about gothic. You can find an audience, and they're so enthusiastic, mm-hmm. horror and gothic audiences, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Would you agree?
Absolutely, yeah. Mm. Absolutely.
It's a lovely community. But yeah, and then Book of Darkness and Light happened, and then suddenly, yeah, that was it. I sort of was missed the ghost stories.
I love that. It's never looked back. Never looked back. It's. I mean... Yeah, it's a fantastic genre, and I'm similar to you in that I grew up absolutely as a kid reading anything, even vaguely spooky, and studying like European Gothic at university, and just fully amazing. Embracing that. And as you say, actually, you're saying that kind of first play had an element of haunting. Like, it's amazing how many things are infused with like a flavor of the gothic or something ghostly, as you say, like, you know, memory, trauma, family, anything. There are so many sort of ghostly elements, haunting elements, horrific elements. I always like to argue that just about every film I've watched has got an element of horror in it. They're such, you know, they're universal things. It's such a unifying genre.
And I'm really drawn to them and in theatre, it's, you know, there aren't that many horror, like I'm sure there are actually loads and loads and loads of horror plays, but there aren't that many horror plays that are that everybody would know about. Let's put it that way. Like, you know, you're not going to pick up your local theatre guide and see, you know, several Gothic plays on all at once, unless they're doing a season or something. And likewise, when I studied at uni, we didn't really look at sort of Gothic theatre or horror theatre or anything like that. But I was always drawn to the elements of theatre that were horrific and were, you know, had Gothic language or Gothic themes. And I think, yeah, I don't know whether it was that grounding as a kid that just made me, I don't know, I find it quite magnetic and hard to shake. So even when I'm doing something that's outside of that realm, outside of that genre, I find that the sort of the delicious language of the Gothic creeps in, you know what I mean?
Absolutely, yeah. And some of the writers you sort of frequently reference are names like M.R. James, of course, Elizabeth Gaskell, Edith Wharton, Hugh Walpole, the types that are often seen as sort of the masters of short Gothic fiction who lived and were writing sort of Gothic horror stories around the same time. So, you know, a fair while ago in kind of later 19th, early 20th century. What is it about the storytelling from these writers that you think has sort of stood the test of time?
Yeah, it's a good question. There's something quite cozy, I think, about Edwardian and Victorian ghost stories. And they are sort of the blueprint to a certain extent, I think. And I don't know. I think it's when people try to riff on M.R. James and they change it too much. I just think to myself, I don't know why you're doing that actually, because it works really well as
it is. Keep it as is, yeah.
And I understand the need to be fresh and contemporary, and I'm not suggesting that people shouldn't try new things with Gothic. Of course they should, and some incredible modern Gothic writers that are doing incredible things. But I think it is the blueprint. I think it's something that we all know, the atmosphere of like an Edwardian ghost story. If you think of being told a ghost story, that I think is the first thing that people think of, you know, gathering around a fire or a campfire or the hearth of an indoor fire, being told this in slightly hushed tones, and that dialogue that ghost stories have as well, that you're being told this almost in confidence and it's just for your ears and they don't really feel comfortable telling it. And I think that feels like it began in earnest with people like M.R. James. Obviously, you've got people way before that who were, you know, Dickens was doing it, and you've got people like W.W. Jacobs and things like that who are classic big hitters in the ghost story world. But I think it seems to sort of crystallize in the way that we know it now in that Edwardian period with M.R. James and things like that. And I was speaking to Robert Lloyd Parry on a podcast, and Robert Lloyd Parry does incredible M.R. James performances. He sort of is M.R. James in these performances. And I was speaking to him about M.R. James, and he said something really interesting, which is that I always think it's a bit like a club, M.R. James. You say it to someone and they go, oh yeah, I love M.R. James. And it's really exciting and you're sort of in the gang and that's great. And he said, yeah, and I've never known anyone who has read M.R. James's work who doesn't like it. Mm. And I think that's amazing, because I can think of loads of artists, loads of writers who loads of people have read, and some people love them and some people hate them and everything in between. But I am the same thing. I have never met anyone who's read M.R. James and sort of gone, nah, not for me really.
No, no, I think you're right, actually. It's a good point. I would agree. But I think those stories are, I say simple, they're not simple, but they are... they're simple to a point, and it is just so effective. And as you say, it's that atmosphere, it's that uncanny feeling that really sticks with you. And I don't think you can deny the power of that. And especially so if you see someone perform as M.R. James in person,
it's amazing.
Watching and listening to the storytelling element as well of that over like candlelight or something is just like,
And the tropes have stuck around massively. You know, if you think about things like The Ring, think about things like It Follows, obviously, you know, Night of the Demon, But the whole idea of a curse which has rules attached to it, which you then pass on to other people, that was really prominent in M.R. James's as writing. You know, there were sort of strange rules attached to objects or particular areas or whatever, that if you break those rules, then, you know, something then pursues you. And I'm not saying that M.R. James invented that, but certainly it was very, very present in his work. And I watched something like a movie like It Follows, and I think, yeah, this is very much an M.R. James story in very, you know, a really contemporary version with lots of stuff that he wouldn't have liked. But yeah, I think the influence of that period in terms of writing is still there in fantastic examples in movies.
Mm. And some of those Jamesian, well, they're not Jamesian, but some of those elements, as you say, like an anonymous storyteller, the sort of layers of storytelling, you know, use of found documents, you've got stories buried within stories. Those are things that you can find in your writing, especially the sort of play text that I've been reading of yours there. It feels like you've very much taken inspiration from those writers for your...
Yeah, I think so. I mean, again, the Book of Darkness and Light is a project that came together kind of by accident, and so it was just an outpouring of the first story that we ever did, an outpouring of love for that genre. It was just like, I love this genre, I'm going to do something, I'm going to do like a little tribute to it. I hope is that our stories have that nod to the traditional. I hope that they feel contemporary in some ways. You know, we don't change the format of the ghost story too much, but I hope that they feel like their story is written by a contemporary writer, if that makes sense.
Yes.
I think that Book Darkness Light is really a love letter to the gothic and to horror. And the more shows we do, actually, the more we sort of diversify into different areas of horror. Even in Shivers, you know, which is the second show that we toured, you've got something in the middle. You've got three stories in the second story, you know, has nods to things like Ghostwatch, even things like Psycho 4 with the radio phone in. And so we're always trying to do something unexpected within the fabric of this familiar portmanteau ghost story experience, you know.
And with storytelling that kind of sets out to unnerve or an unease or scare readers, I feel like that's a real challenge, to build this kind of tension or atmosphere on the page effectively. I'm sure it's not easy to do on a screen at all, I'm not saying that, but it feels like a particular challenge when someone is reading a story like that. Would you agree, firstly?
I think I would. I think there are challenges in all areas of media when you're trying to make something scary. They all have their own challenges. I think a movie, if you've got an incredible budget, an incredible director and an incredible team and performers, of course, then actually, yeah, you put all those things together, you're going to end up with something that's effective and scary. The thing that we do is we strip it all back, you know, completely to nothing, really. It's storytelling, it's live music, and we do, you know, it's theatrical. We have, lighting design, sound design, and we have some moments of that you might expect to experience in a horror movie, like jump scares and things like that. But we use those sparingly. And the other thing that I think that I try to work hard on getting right is the dialogue with the audience. Because it's storytelling, in fact, the audience are doing an awful lot of the construction of the scares, you know? So I can tell you a story, but because it's kind of ghostly fiction, it's weird fiction, it's gothic fiction, there are these big gaps in there. There are moments where I will suggest an image to you, but I'm not showing you the ghoul or the revenant or whatever. I'm just describing it in quite loose terms, and your brain rushes in and it constructs that image, and it's a dialogue between you and me. And the thing that we do on stage is it's very much me telling the audience stories, you know, it's me telling the audience a story. And so it is intimate, because I'm telling you, You know, I'm telling you, Steph, in the audience. And when people, you know, I have to say, we've got a lovely supportive audience, and every time we sort of do a new tour, we sort of grow that audience, and people are so kind about the shows. They really seem to enjoy them, and they're a thrill, you know, really thrilling to put on. But I always feel when they say these nice things, I think you're doing quite a lot of that yourself. I don't know if you realize this, but you're actually doing a lot of it yourself. With Upon the Stair, which is the last show we did, we had me, we had Chloe Hayward on violin, because Ben had moved on to Pastures New. And we also had Raffi Julian. And Raffi is an actor. She's deaf. She's profoundly deaf. And Raffi performed Upon the Stair using a combination of BSL, British Sign Language, and a thing called VV, which is, it's an art form, essentially, and it is visual vernacular. And it's essentially, it's got elements it's a really difficult thing to describe, because it seems to have elements of like mime and dance and movement and BSL kind of all combined into this incredible art form, which is almost like watching somebody perform an entire film with their body, their hands. It's so incredible. So we had Raffi as part of that. One of the thoughts I had was, and obviously we did that because, you know, it's important to make theatre accessible for as many people as you can. We wanted to do this show so that we could have a piece of theatre that was accessible for hearing and deaf audiences alike. And I had some questions about how the hearing audience as well would experience, you know, Raffi's incredible performance. And the reason I had that question was because when it's storytelling, those gaps, as I say, in Gothic are really important. It's really important to have that gap so that you can get involved in that dialogue. And I wondered how much extra you were adding with this visual performance. I was excited about it, I must say. I wasn't, it wasn't something I was worried about. I was really excited about it. But the audience's reaction, and a lot of hearing audience members as well, the reaction was incredible, and they were just so excited to have this extra element to the Book of Darkness and Light experience, and it was amazing. Yeah, so we're going to be doing, in fact, we got some money recently to do an R&D from Arts Council England, have given us some support to do a research and development project for a forthcoming show, which is going to be called Unhomely. And that is going to include BSL. It's also going to include audio description, elements of audio description. Mm-hmm. So it's this hopefully really widely accessible, that's the aim, really widely accessible piece of theatre. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, I think it's all about a dialogue. That was a very long way of saying,
no,
Steph.
I think that's really interesting, actually. I really hope I get to see one of these plays at some point, fingers crossed. Yeah, I mean, as all of those things kind of came to me as I was reading these play texts. So I read Shivers and I read The Book of Darkness and Light. And as you say, it has a very stripped down quality. And it is that there's an element of suggestion there, especially with, you know, the horrors that are faced by these characters. Mm. It's all in the suggestion and in the gaps, as you say. We're not being told explicitly what is in front of you. And it is that kind of cozy campfire, kind of being told a campfire story or told a story by someone, and you're imagining, you know, you're bringing the story to life in front of you. Mm. So yeah, I can absolutely see, it's just, yeah, I can imagine how effective that would be, and much amazing. In some ways much more effective than just having having a very busy stage, having everything in front of you, being just handed a complete product, and you know.
Yeah, I think I've been to see a few horror plays in my life, some with big budgets, some with little budgets. I think like something like The Woman in Black is a masterclass on how to use, you know, a really good budget, a really good production design to make it seem minimal when actually there's an awful lot that goes into it. But yeah. I think if you don't have the resources to create something that looks incredible, that looks kind of like on a par with like a, you know, Hollywood horror movie, There are still ways you can you can explore horror and storytelling. And I like I say, I'm a big fan of storytelling. I love being told stories and I love experiencing them. So I think if people are interested in sort of looking at how to do horror on stage, I think there are ways to do it where you don't have to rely too much on, I guess, you know, expensive visuals is one way of putting it.
The other thing I wanted to ask about these kind of plays in particular is you've chosen to structure, and you've mentioned this, you've chosen to structure these plays in a particular way. So you've got this storyteller who is relaying three separate stories over the course of the play. So it's a three-part structure. And in the introduction to Shivers, you talk about the difficulty of writing that middle section, which you've already kind of alluded to. So the middle story in this three-part play, and how it has to be both like a palate cleanser and a gear change. Can you talk a bit about your approach to structuring these plays and what you mean by the importance and sort of difficulty of that middle act?
Yeah, it is tricky, that middle one. It's always tricky. I think that I really like portmanteau horror. Mm. So I like anthology horror where, you know, you stick on a movie and it's got like four or five different stories in it. I love the history of that with like Amicus and the Hammer movies and stuff like that. I'm really into it. I think that it works really well with contemporary tastes as well, I must say. People are quite, you know, I don't know whether this is true, but I feel like my attention span wanes more than it used to sort of 10 years ago because of the fast pace of life and stuff and what's available to us. I think that the way I approach it is I think about the fact that we want one big story. That's the first thing I think of. We want one big story, which will be the third act. It'll be the longest story and it'll be the most complex. It'll have that detective element. I'm not saying they're detective stories, but it's like M.R. James did. It's got this detective element where you as an audience member are on board for this uncovering of a supernatural mystery almost. Then the first story I always feel is like a ramp into the show.
Yeah.
So it has to have a couple of moments of like proper scares where people go, oh, here we go, you know, we're off. And it has to be something that has some really strong visual images so that people are just on board from the start, right? That, you know, it's usually about a 20-minute story, the first one, and it has to be something simple, arresting, intriguing, and with, you know, some good scary moments and scary images. And with both The Book of Darkness and Light and Shivers, I guess you could say that story one and story three share a certain vibe. There's something about them that has a similarity. They feel like we're in familiar territory here.
Yes.
We know that these are ghost stories. But I have always felt that the middle story, the second story, if you were to do another story that had a similar vibe, that kind of Edwardian vibe, I think people would drift off a bit and would be like, I don't really need another one now. You've done two in this ilk. I don't need a third story. And the problem with that is that you're sending them away after the interval to come back to see yet more.
Another one.
What they've already seen. So this is what I mean by palate cleanser. I think the second story has to do something completely different. In the first play, Girl Dancing is the piece, and it's way more poetic than the other things. It's way more lyrical in its writing. It's got a contemporary aspect because it's about urban photographers who sort of go into broken down buildings and take photos. It's also not scary. It's this very sad piece. The music was totally different. It had this very different quality to it, and it was always, as I say, really sad. When we did it at Christmas time, we would actually use the Coventry Carol as the music for Girl Dancing, which is this incredibly mournful Christmas carol. And in Shivers, when I came to write Shivers, I realized that the second story had to be something entirely different from the other two. So what I decided was to do a dialogue, even though it was just going to be me on stage. So I wrote this radio phone in which firstly allowed a different voice to come in to proceedings, because people have been listening to me for 20 minutes already. You know, I can't think of anything worse. And it also had a way more contemporary setting. So it was a complete reset. You'd had this story which was set in the 60s, I think. The New Priest of Black Pines, I think it's set in the 60s. I should probably know that, but it's a long time since I've since I've done it. I think it was set in the 60s. I'm just gonna have a look now. And then the second story was set in the 90s. It's kind of this 90s phone-in based on when I was a kid, there used to be a phone-in on, I think it was Pulse FM, and it was this nightly phone-in, and it was like an agony aunt phone-in.
Yeah.
But some of them were really intense. Some of them were like people ringing up with really, really difficult stories, and I was like, gosh, this is a really interesting medium to tell stories because it's unpredictable. So that was that. And the way we did it on stage was we'd have a pre-recorded voice, and I would sit there just in this little spotlight. It didn't move at all in that story, just completely stuck to the seat. And it was all about sound rather than kind of any kind of movement, and about this dialogue. And when it came to Upon the Stair, anybody who came to see Upon the Stair will know this, and we're really hoping it's going to tour. We've got plans to tour it in 2022, but COVID has just knocked everything for six. Yeah. Steph, you know. Yeah. So we're really hoping. But the second story, people will know that I'm not in it at all. Mm. We made this call that the whole of the middle story in Upon the Stair, Raffi was going to be the only person on stage, the only actor on stage. Chloe remains on stage playing violin. And the whole story is presented in BSL and VV and movement. And you have an audio voice telling the story, performed by Lindsay Aldrich. And again, it's a total reset. The whole thing shifts and becomes something totally different. So that's it, really. The second story is always the quickest to write, but it always takes me the longest to come up with the concept.
Yeah, you've got to keep everyone on board with you, haven't you? As you say, you're holding everyone's attention, doing something a little bit different. So it's actually a very important part of that entire
I think
it's crucial.
And it's interesting. My mum came along to see the very first performance of Upon the Stair, and she said to me afterwards, she said, "Oh, my favourite was Mirror Man." It's the name of the story, Mirror Man. I was like, "Oh, but the one that I'm not in at all." Great, thanks, mum. <That's-
laughs> I really love the one that had you weren't in at all. That was lovely, brilliant.
And I have to convince my mum as well. She always says to me, like, she's never quite sure. She'll say to me, "And did you write all of it? Did you write all of that?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I did. Honestly,
I promise." Parents like that?
Yeah, I know.
That's a classic parent thing, isn't it?
I know. She also came to see a performance of The Book of Darkness and Light. And she loved Conscientious, which was the first, as I said, the first touring show that I did. She loved it. My mum's not a theatre goer, really. Not the sort of stuff I sort of write. She loves going to musicals and stuff like that, but she wouldn't come along with me necessarily to go see a play. Mm. She came along. She loved it. She raved about it, which is obviously just lovely for me. Really nice for her to say those things. But she never stops talking about it. So whenever I do something new, she will sort of go up to the people involved in that production and say, "And did you see Conscientious?" And it's like, "Mom, thank you, but focus on this one. Say something nice about this one." So she did that. I said to Ben when we did The Book of Darkness and Light, she will say that to you. And he was like, he was a bit doubtful. It was the first thing she said to him.
Is it?
Well done. That was really good. Did you see Conscientious? So,
I love that. Parents.
Good old parents.
I think when my dad first listened to a podcast I'd done, he just like couldn't believe it was me. He was like, "I didn't know you could do that sort of thing." Like, thanks for underestimating me. It's like, no, I'm just surprised.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think my family just baffled in some ways about what I've ended up doing. Like, I really, that's what I think. I think that, you know, my other two brothers, my older brother, I think he works in management in a paper mill, and my younger brother's an electrician.
Very different beasts.
Really, yeah, really different. And you know, we get on really well. But I think my interests as a kid were really different to their interests, and that's what sort of pushed me in that direction, really. But my family just don't ask really about. I mean, my mum does a bit, I must say, but my dad just doesn't really ask about it, because I think he's just outside of what he's interested in, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he has his interest. You know, we all have different interests, don't we? So it's fair enough.
Well, I believe my dad decided to buy and watch Eraserhead after I did that one podcast. And I was like, Dad, this is like categorically not a thing you would watch, like big Jason Statham fan. Like, just don't do it. And he did it anyway and was like, I'm never doing that again. That was horrible.
This was, yeah. Right, that's it. This was with Mike, wasn't it? Mike Munster,
yes,
on
yeah.
I loved that episode. And the thing about that podcast and that episode included is it does make you go, I've got to go watch that film right now.
Really intriguing.
Yeah, because it's the love of it. It's people talking passionately about it. So that's good. I'm glad that your dad did that. I'm sorry that he didn't enjoy it.
I spotted the DVD at the bottom of his pile when I last went to his house. I was like, shall I put this in the charity shop for you? Or it's like, yeah, I'm never watching that again. That was like, fair enough. Anyway, yeah, exactly. I thought I didn't expect that. So we were talking about that kind of middle section and Dead Air, which is this second story in Shivers. It's this kind of sort of radio play. And I know you love podcasting as well. Have you thought about doing a kind of radio play style podcast or like an audio play of sorts?
I have, yeah. I mean, last year we were talking to a theatre, Harrogate Theatre, about the idea of doing a filmed version of A Christmas Carol, which is a play that a version of that story. We tour that, or we have toured it at Christmas time, and hoping to again this Christmas. Certainly the venues are all booked. Anyway, tangent. But it didn't happen. We didn't do this film version, but we did talk then about doing an audio version. So I basically produced what was called A Christmas Carol, the festive audio experience. And it was my version of A Christmas Carol, slightly adapted. I mean, it's really, really, really faithful to Dickens' original, using the same language and all that stuff. But I tease out the gothic stuff and I make that bigger, and I make the images and the sounds bigger. And I basically produced this radio play, which was then broadcast live and people bought tickets for it. But before that, as you'll know, I was doing like little broadcasts of the stories from the Book of Darkness and Light, Shivers and things like that. And I produced them myself. And this was right in the thick of the first lockdown. I produced them myself at home, and I would stream them live, and audiences from, as it turned out, all around the world would tune in during the pandemic, and we'd all listen to this ghost story together, and then I'd do a little Q&A at the end. And so I've got all these audio tales, which I use, which I put on Patreon. I have a Patreon. And I do keep thinking to myself, do you know what? This is like the makings of a fairly decent series of a podcast. So it's a thought I've had. I think obviously it's one of the perks of my Patreon. So it's a conversation I would want to have with people on Patreon before I just sort of went, hey, this is now for free. But I do like doing it. It takes a long time to produce them for me because they're sort of self-taught skills. Mm. And obviously writing something new takes a long time. And, I've got other things that I need to, focus on, because what I tend to find is that the jobs that come in where I have an end point where I need to have a play written by this particular point obviously have to take priority over you know, something that is a bit unpredictable in terms of what the return will be, if that makes sense. That makes it sound really horrible in corporate, doesn't it? But it's true.
I think that's realistic. Yeah.
You've got to earn that one. Yeah, exactly. But I have definitely thought about doing a fictional audio series for sure, and it feels inevitable, to be honest.
It's going to happen at some point if you can fit it into your schedule. I would say so too. And actually, I wanted to ask you about the sort of the effect of the pandemic, even though we're all extremely bored of talking about that in particular. But you did a very good job of moving quickly into an online format and sort of adapting your work, as you say, so you could continue to run workshops and sort of showcase and perform your own stories to viewers and listeners all over the world. What was the experience of running those kind of workshops and performing your work? What was that like? Is it difficult to sort of, I guess this is tackling two things at once. We might want to separate them. But in terms of performing your work, is it difficult to create the right kind of atmosphere over a webcam? Did you find sort of the audience engagement, did that work quite well performing over sort of live over Zoom and things like that?
The live stream stories were something that I came to a little bit later in the whole lockdown thing, the whole pandemic. It was actually something that I did in the last few months rather than the workshops came first, really. But in terms of creating the atmosphere, I think that actually of all the things out there that were available during obviously the various lockdowns, storytelling was the thing that I found as an audience member worked the best, because it's kind of the same. It's not that different from being in a room. I mean, between you and me, of course it is. It's massively different. And being in a room with somebody is incredible when they're telling a story. But you know, for all intents and purposes, it's the same sort of thing. It's intimate. It's you watching that one person. They're telling a story. The way I saw lots of people doing it in different ways. The one thing I spotted about some of the productions out there was that if they were trying to go for production values of any sort, I felt I was distracted by that. Mm-hmm. And so what I decided to do was literally have a single candle flame and me, and that was it. That's how I decided to do it, mainly because my study, as you can see, is not very scary. It's quite a nice space.
Quite light and airy and lovely. Yeah,
exactly. So I decided to do it like that. I put on the costume that I wear on stage, and I have been really, really blown away really by the lovely things people have said. You know, I've always done it as a sort of pay what you decide thing, suggested ticket amount, but it's a fiver and people can pay whatever they want. It seems to work for people. I did it as an experiment because I didn't know whether it would work or not, but the whole, I guess the pandemic has sort of allowed me to explore these other areas of doing stuff online. And to be honest with you, if people keep coming to them, I'm going to keep doing them.
I was going to ask whether that was something that you'd sort of want to continue to do, because the workshops I did with you were, you know, fantastic. It was lovely to be able to do those from home as well. And they seem to be very popular and very successful.
Yeah. I mean, the right at the start of the pandemic, my first thought was I need to do something because I'm not very good when I'm not working. Like I need something to focus on. I'm a bit obsessed with work. It's not that healthy, I think, perhaps. I forget.
It's difficult when you love what you do and you know, it becomes sort of a mix of it is work, but it's also there's a big personal aspect to that, isn't it?
Yeah. And also when you work for yourself, when you're self-employed, like, you know,
you can't take 6 months off, that's for sure.
Well, no, we can. I guess you can, but I'm not in the position to be able to. So I feel like when I'm not working, I should be working, which again is not a very healthy attitude. But that was my first thought. I thought, I need to do something. I also thought, well, now everybody, like Friday night when people go to the pub or the cinema or whatever, that they can't. There's obviously we're all stuck indoors. So I was like, well, maybe I can combine these two problems. And I put something on my Facebook Book That's Like group, a little video of me saying, look, I think I might do a workshop next Friday. If people fancy coming along, I don't know how it's going to work. I've never done one online before. It might be a bit of a disaster, but come along and let's see what happens. Mm. And I said, I'm going to need 10 people to be there. Otherwise, it's kind of, you know, it won't really work if it's much fewer than 10. And like, I think like 80 or 90 people turned up to the first
Maybe
one.
Maybe too many people.
Yeah. But actually, the funny thing is with online workshops, the thing that's challenging is the sharing of work, because mm-hmm. for me, and I'm sure lots of writers that you speak to, a similar approach, Steph, in terms of workshops. One of the most important things is people sharing their work in workshops. Mm-hmm. For me, it feels like it's really great for them to give their work an airing. It feels like it really develops that sense of community in the room, and really quickly the group are a group.
Yeah,
that's what I find over like a 90 minute window. I was doing them on Facebook to start with. And the problem was that it wasn't a two-way dialogue. It was just mm-hmm. me and the comments. So I figured out a way, and people sent me their work, and I sort of said on camera, you know, you're giving me permission to read your work out, all that stuff. And I did it like that. And actually, the thing that I thought was going to be a nightmare and the biggest hurdle worked really well.
Yeah.
And aside from the very, very sad fact that it wasn't the person speaking their own work with their own voice, which I genuinely, you know, that's the thing that bugged me about it, because that is such an important part of workshops, I think. But it worked. And mm-hmm. I sort of set up this donation thing where I sort of said, look, you know, these are completely free. And if you can't afford to give a donation, you are still as welcome as anybody else. If you can afford to give a donation, here's a website. You know, if you want to chuck something into the hat, you can. And basically, it ended up being a viable thing to do. Like, it was amazing. I mean, don't get me wrong, every few months it all changed.
Yeah.
And people's habits changed and numbers dipped. And, you know, people who had been extremely generous, you know, in donating something at the start, were now like, you know what, I can't necessarily afford to give something every time, which is completely fine, of course. I understand that. So it was really, as for everybody working in an area that was affected by the pandemic, it was pretty scary. Mm. And every month I had no idea what was going to happen. But it was fun, and this incredible community of about sort of 600 people that's still active, by the way. I'll give you the website address, so that's right. This community popped up out of nowhere, and they're just all ace. They're really talented writers and lovely people and enthusiastic creatives and love ghost stories.
Yeah. And they've been doing their own kind of writing slots, haven't they? Like weekly tune-ins, everyone kind of writes together, and that really creating that sense of community online, which, yeah, prior to the pandemic, I would have been like, I don't know if that's going to be very effective or very possible. But
that's
it's wonderful.
I think it's opened a lot of doors in that way. It's obviously, you know, I don't need to say how horrible and challenging this whole period has been. That is absolutely a given. But I think that there have been some things that have come out of it, such as you say, communities like that are really positive. And the other thing that you alluded to earlier is accessibility as well, because people can come to these things from home. And I've had a lot of messages from people saying, thanks so much for doing it, because I can't get to the theatre.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't go to see shows. And sometimes it's an accessibility thing, and sometimes it's other things. But it, you know, in terms of accessibility, I think it is something that theatres and all arts organisations should think about pursuing and continuing.
Yeah. I think we've certainly had that at work. You know, we've always done a lot of, we've done some, actually we were doing some creative writing courses online prior to the pandemic, but you know, all of our kind of short courses, you know, 2-hour workshops, events were all taking place in person, which is lovely. And I love the atmosphere of doing things in person, but actually, you know, the online things have been pretty seamless. They've been really popular. Mm. We've had really good feedback. So I think we absolutely would carry on doing those, as well as doing the in-person bits and pieces, because it just gives everyone an opportunity to take part, doesn't it?
Yeah. And I really hope they do carry on in like, I went to see this talk on like weird objects in the British Museum, and it was just this Eventbrite thing. And to be honest with you, if it had been, you know, an hour's bus ride away, I probably wouldn't have gone.
Yeah.
Like, it was one of those things where it was like £8, and I was like, this sounds really interesting. But whether I could have summoned the energy to step outside of my house and go, you know, and travel 40 minutes or whatever.
If you had a busy day, it's like, oh, if you know exactly, what, I'm just going to sack it off.
Exactly. And it was so interesting. And the production values were nil. It was one guy on Zoom with some slides. And it was perfect. It was perfect. So I really hope these things carry on. And I think that there is absolutely a place for going to the theatre, going to talks, going to lectures, whatever, and also having these events that are online. And yeah, as I say, from my perspective, it's allowed me to push into these different directions that actually for a self-employed person are pretty reassuring, because I now know, or I now assume, that if I hit a period where I'm really not very busy at all and it's kind of worrying, I can do a run of workshops. I can do a workshop course. And if I, you know, push it and market it and people help me market it well enough, it's actually quite reassuring.
Yeah.
In a roundabout way, and hopefully, as we've been saying, gives people something to do from their own homes.
Yeah. And this sort of feeds into your, you mentioned your Patreon earlier. So
yeah.
I recently became a member of your Patreon, which is...
Welcome.
Thank you so much. It's a fantastic way to stay connected to your audience and also generate that kind of, you know, a regular stream of, you know, income for your work.
Yeah.
Could you give for anyone who doesn't know, could you sort of just give a quick overview of what Patreon is and how you use it?
Yeah. So it's a platform where I think anybody can set up a profile and invite people to support them. So, you know, you might be an artist, or you might be a podcast creator, or in my case, obviously, I'm a writer and I do the workshops and stuff. And it's a place where you can give exclusive content to people as a sort of thank you for their monthly support. So in my case, it's like a fiver a month is the starting amount. It goes up to different amounts, but everybody more or less gets exactly the same. So it's everyone gets access to the ghost stories as things stand at the moment. Everyone gets access to the workshops. If people are giving a little bit more, sometimes when I do discounts for certain things, they get a little bit more of a discount. But I sort of said from the start, look, I want to make this kind of, it doesn't really matter about how much you're giving. It's about the support. And I'm really grateful. I know some people do it in tiers, and that's great too. You have a tier where you get access to certain things if you pay a bit more, all that kind of thing. But ultimately, it's just a place where people, particularly, I think those people who've been hanging out with me online for the last 18 months, a place where they can support what I'm doing, because it is a really precarious time for creatives. It's really precarious and challenging for people making theatre, you know, in the sense of, you know, we don't know what's going to happen, etc. And it's just a place where, you know, I do workshops regularly. I put up those audio ghost stories that we talked about. I do like little behind the scene video things where I'm sort of talking about my process or something that's happening, a project I'm working on. I announce things on there first. They get discounts to live theatre shows when I can swing that for them. And it's great. Yeah, I really appreciate it. I really, really appreciate it. Like, you know, I'm not at a place where that is my main income or anything like that at the present moment. But it's a massive and has been an incredibly reassuring thing during a period when, obviously, I work in theatre and they were closed.
Yeah.
You know, we had a show that was touring, that was supposed to tour, and that couldn't happen. And I had another play called Smile Club, which was supposed to tour, and that was curtailed by COVID. It's just been a really brilliant place for me to put out these little bits of content, and also I've just had this lovely supportive community. And some people have been there since the start, and some people jump in and out. You know, they'll come along, they'll stick around for a couple of months, and then say, oh, you know, I'm going to have to duck out for a few months, and then they come back. And it's great, and I'm so grateful. I'm so grateful to them. It's ace. And thank you, Steph, for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. I was like, wow, look at all this content I've unlocked. It's brilliant. And I get to, yeah, you know, keep an eye out for the workshops and things like that.
Yeah.
I think, as you say, it's like a, it works for everyone because as, you know, I want to support you, but I'm getting all these cool things back. There is a sense of community there.
It's,
you know,
And we do like we're doing like little weird things, we'll get together and do true ghost story evenings. Now I must say I'm a skeptic where it comes to true ghost stories, which is something that surprises some people.
I'm the same. Yeah. Total skeptic, but love listening to them.
Absolutely. And also I'm sort of very cards on the table about it. I'm not there to sort of laugh at people's story that I don't believe. I sort of say, look, I don't believe in ghosts, but I do believe you had that experience and that's why it's interesting to me. Yeah. So we do these true ghost story evenings where people come along. Sometimes it's true stories that have happened to them, sometimes it's true stories that have happened to their relatives and stuff, and other times, like next week, we're doing one which is basically just true ghost stories from your town. So people can get online, they can do a bit of a search and find out, and we just get together and on Zoom and kind of just have this little almost like an open mic night.
It is.
And it's just ace. It's just lovely, and it brings a bunch of people together. I love it.
That's brilliant. That's really, really good. I encourage anyone to join up if it sounds interesting to them, because it's great, great fun. What is, now that things are opening up, fingers crossed, theatres are getting moving again, what have you got coming up? What's in the pipeline? Because as I say, you're always very busy.
I'm this is not a complaint, but I'm really busy at the moment, and it's really good. I cannot you know, it's all I've ever wanted to do is this is write, and I'm doing it, and it's my job, and I feel delighted about that, and very, very happy with you know, every day I sit down and work, and I don't always feel happy about what I'm about to do, but I feel, you know, there's a sense of happiness about that I'm able to do this job. But at the moment, I was commissioned a few months ago by the Dukes in Lancaster to write a play based on a local crime story from 1935 in Lancaster. And it's a story about, it's a murder story. It's about two women who were murdered in 1935. And I didn't know anything about the story. It's kind of an infamous story within the city. And it was based on the fact that they wanted to do this radio play live. And they'd heard, one of the people involved was Paul Cooper, who was involved in A Christmas Carol that I did back in December. And so I was like, this sounds really interesting. I sort of checked it out, read up on it, and I was like, this sounds really interesting. I want to approach it in a certain way where, you know, we don't sort of foreground the murderer, set off on this mission of research, which took me to the National Archives in Kew. Took me just down this complete rabbit warren of research, and it's unlike anything I've ever done before. I think there was an element to begin with of perhaps the theatre. They knew that I did Gothic stuff. I think there was perhaps an element of them wondering if I would approach it from a similar perspective. I haven't at all. You'll have to come along and see, but it's the least Gothic thing I've ever done. I've tried to make it very respectful to the two victims. It's called Belle and Mary, and it will be on in November at the Dukes in Lancaster. So I'm in the thick of that at the moment, and it's working with a director called Martha Simon, who's so cool, and we seem to get on. We've never worked together before. We seem to get on really well, and she's got some amazing ideas. And that's all coming together. But it's been a process of intense research, and then constantly discovering new stuff, and going, no, I can't now open that door. But you have to take it on board. If you find something out, I read an oral histories thing the other day, which said something about one of the victims that kind of made me think about something in a different way. And I'm now going back to the script and wondering how I reflect this, you know, but I'm on like draft 7 or 8 of the full script. And it's been amazing. Like the redrafting has been so difficult and challenging, but the process has been amazing. I'm really nervous about it because it's, you know, it was 1935, but it's people, you know, it's real people.
Yeah.
It's not, I'm not.
There's an added responsibility there, isn't there? You must.
Yeah. And I feel like I've done, you know, lots of, well, I've done so much research, but I feel like I'm doing due diligence. Mm. And trying to stick to what's factual and then kind of expanding on that from with a sort of slightly authorial voice.
That was going to be my question, actually, is how are you kind of striking that balance between fact and fiction? And that must be difficult.
It is. I mean, for me, without going too much into it, there are some interesting attitudes towards the murderer online and within some groups that actually it's almost like I wouldn't say it was a fondness, but it's like oh, he was driven to this crime because of jealousy, because he thought his wife was having an affair, and then he killed the nursemaid because she witnessed it, and I was really bothered by that, and I'm still really bothered by it. So my play is an attempt to say, here are the facts, here's the testimony of all these people. My conclusion is very different to, oh, he was driven to it. Mm-hmm. My conclusion is something that this is something that was happening for a long time, and was, you know, was building up to the murders for a long time. Not that it was necessarily like planned intricately or anything like that, but that it was, you know, it was really building up to it.
Like a snowball effect of.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, domestic abuse plays a huge part from my perspective. And it seems to be, you know, accepted by lots of people who've written on this case. And so, yeah, I feel like what I'm trying to do is present the facts in a narrative in an almost slightly dispassionate way, which is like, this is what happened. This is what people, these are witness testimonies. This is how it unfolded. And then the end kind of bringing the second act kind of starting to bring in some of these conclusions, and it's presented as a chorus of voices. That's how we're presenting it. So it's four voices who are telling you this story. And they have arguments between them, and they have conversations about it, and they ask difficult questions, and somebody will respond to it within the chorus. So I feel as if I know what my perspective is. I feel as if the play tries to present different perspectives, but ultimately my perspective, is the bit that is focused on towards the end. But yeah, it's I'm really scared about putting it out there into the world. But it's happening, so off it goes.
It sounds like it's in very skilled, very good hands. So I'm
thank
sure.
you, I appreciate it. I'm really, like I said, I'm really, really trying my best to to treat it carefully, to treat it with care, and not take too many leaps that aren't really evident within the facts of what happened. And I feel as if any counter arguments that there might be, we're having like a talk back event as well. So any sort of counter arguments that they might be, I'm really happy to hear them and listen to them. But what I hope is that I have considered them and I may disagree with them, but I've got good reasons for disagreeing with them. And then the other thing that we're doing is we had a play called Smile Club, which toured Red Ladder, the amazing Red Ladder theatre company, produced this play that I'd written with my dear friend, Andrea Heaton. And Andrea and I, over a series of, 3 or 4 years, did an R&D, you know, research and development period, showed it to some people. One of them was Rod Dixon from Red Ladder Creative, the artistic director. He really liked it. And said, you know, in a conversation with Andrea, it was decided that, you know, it was going to be part of Red Ladder's offer that particular year. So then they toured it. That began at the Leeds Playhouse, and was set to go on a tour of the UK, and it was this incredible tour as well, like all over the place, as well as sort of community places. So it was going to be this brilliant theatre tour, as well as going to some really unusual and exciting places. That obviously was curtailed. And Andrea and I, it's a bit of a long story, but to cut that very short, we decided that we would do an audio version of it. And we were lucky enough to get some Arts Council funding to create a 6-part audio series of Smile Club. So we've been spending the last, almost done 6-7 months, maybe longer. Anyway, writing, expanding the show from like a one hour and 10 minute theatre show to a 6-part, wow, 30 minute audio series, you know, new characters, new arcs, new bits of narrative, but kind of following the blueprint of the original show. Nothing's ever done, is it? But more or less done. The script is more or less done. And that's, we're really hoping it's going to come out towards the end of this year. We really hope. That's the plan at the moment. It may get pushed into early next year, but we really hope it'll be this year. And it's going out as a podcast.
Wonderful. Brilliant.
Yeah, because we wanted it to reach as many people as possible. So those two things are keeping me pretty busy.
Very, very busy. We will have to let me know as soon as that gets launched as well, and we can share that on our channels.
And then we're touring Christmas Carol in December.
Of course, well. If that wasn't enough, just chuck a bit of Christmas Carol on there as well.
And the other thing, which I forgot, which I was going to tell you about, is the book Darkness and Light, which you've got, I think, haven't you there? Mm-hmm. A theatre in Canada are putting it on in October. So
wow,
there's this theatre. So it's nothing to do with me. They got in touch. They'd ordered the book. They got in touch. And the director there of this place called the Performers Theatre in Sackville, New Brunswick, said, we want to put it on. And we got into the conversation about it. And then... He said, "Well, why don't you come out and you can come and do some interviews and work with the university and stuff." So, fingers crossed.
Are you doing that as well?
Yeah, on the 11th of October, I'm going to be going out for a bit of a holiday first.
Wow, an actual holiday outside of the country as well.
Well, yes, but look, I'm not. Confident it's going to happen. I can't allow myself to believe it.
It still seems so far away, doesn't it?
But, I know.
I very much hope that does happen for you, because that sounds extremely exciting.
Yeah.
And if people would like to follow you online, join your Patreon, where can they find you?
So, thank you. Twitter, I'm @Adam_ZED. So, @Adam_ZED. On Patreon, it's patreon.com/AdamZRobinson. And then the Facebook community group, firstly, you can find me on there on the Book of Darkness and Light. Just sort of search that on Facebook and you'll find us, the Book of Darkness and Light. But the community group is facebook.com/groups/AZR events. And it's a community, it's like 600 people on there. They're all lovely. It's where I announce lots of bits and pieces, but come on there. If you fancy joining me on Patreon, then please do. I do workshops really regularly, audio ghost stories, all that stuff. So yeah, come and say hello. I'd love to have a natter with anybody who would like to natter with me.
I think I could natter with you for the rest of the day, but I will leave it there. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. That was
fantastic. And I'm hoping when our conversation goes out over the Halloween period, it might inspire some people to write some ghost stories.
Oh yeah, definitely. Get involved.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Steph.
Thanks for listening, and big thanks to Adam for coming on and having a chat with us. If you have questions about this episode or anything else we do, you can find us over on Twitter and Instagram @WriterCentre, check out our Facebook page, or head to our website at nationalcentrewriting.org.uk, where you will find handy links to our newsletter and our Discord community channel.
As a UK registered charity, we rely on the generosity of our supporters to make our work possible. You can make a donation over on our website by going to the Support Us page. Please do subscribe to the podcast and leave us a positive review because it helps other people to find us. Thanks again. Keep writing, and we'll catch you on the next episode.